So here is the plan of my talk. We are going to talk about modular symbols and their distribution. This is where I will state the main theorem. The second will be why we are interested in modular symbols and some motivational work for my work coming out of the conjectures of Spiro and Goldfield. Then we are going to talk about Eisenstein series with modular symbols. Those were introduced by Goldfield and his students. Then about Eisenstein series with characters chi epsilon and perturbations of the Laplacian. And at the end, I'll mention a bunch of open problems. So we start with the definition of modular symbols. We start first with f of z, which is a cusp form of weight 2 for a discrete cofinite subgroup of SL to R. For instance, we could take the group to be gamma not n, although in essentially most of the talk, starting with the congruent subgroup or an arithmetic subgroup is absolutely no restriction. Our theorems apply to general cofinite subgroups. Because f of z has weight 2, f of z dz is a one form on the quotient surface, and for instance that quotient could be one of those modular curves x not n. The modular symbol is a pairing between elements in the group gamma and this holomorphic cusp form, which we keep fixed throughout this talk. And the pairing goes as follows. We integrate the differential f of z dz along a path from a fixed point in the upper half plane tau to gamma tau, and the normalizing factor minus 2 pi I, I don't really need it for this talk, but since it's been traditional to put it up there in the case of modular symbols, I keep it. As you see, I'll have to divide the 2 pi and the I later on. It is interesting to realize that this definition is independent of the point tau on the upper half plane, and moreover, if we take gamma to be a parabolic matrix, then, because f is a cusp form, the integral that we are going to get is going to be zero. Another notation that we need is for the matrix gamma, we need the second row to be C and D, and we also need the Petersson norm to measure the size of the holomorphic differential f of z dz, or the same way of the cusp form f of z. We are going to integrate over the quotient y squared, absolute value of f of z squared, times the hyperbolic volume. Okay. And here is the main theorem. I need to normalize the modular symbols, and I need also to arrange the elements of the group in a specific order. So, what kind of normalization do I need for the modular symbols? It is what we see in this line here. And it may seem strange to you at this moment why I use this normalization. I'll make some comments about it. So, first of all, it is clear that if you're going to multiply the cusp form by 2 or by 3, you're going to change the value distribution you're going to get. So somehow you have to normalize by the length of the differential, and that's why we're dividing here by the norm of f. The volume is kind of natural also that it shows up, because we could take the holomorphic cusp form either on gamma or on some subgroup of it. What I cannot explain to you right now is why we see the square root of the logarithm of c squared plus d squared. That I will explain later. So with this normalization, the new normalized modular symbols have a binormal Gaussian distribution in the complex plane with correlation coefficient 0. What does that mean? What is the binormal Gaussian distribution? It's the one that has density x per minus x squared minus y squared over 2. That includes correlation coefficient 0, and in front we need 1 over 2 pi to make it a probability density. The second thing that I need here is the way to arrange the elements in the group. And I'm going to order the elements in the group according to the sum of squares of the second row. In general, of course, we know that since we have parabolic matrices, there are infinitely many elements of the group with the same second row. So I need to divide out by the parabolic matrices, so I'm going to do the following thing. Fix a large number t and denote by gamma infinity mod gamma t to be the matrices in the quotient so that the second row square coefficients give you less than or equal to t. This way, there are going to be finitely many such matrices in gamma. And then out of those matrices, we are going to count how many of them put the normalized modular symbol in a nice set in the complex plane. This nice set R could be a rectangle or some other kind of Jordan set, but I'm not going to insist on that. Take it to be a rectangle. And what we do is that we count how many of those matrices give you a modular symbol in R, divide by the total number of matrices all the way up to height T, and let T go to infinity. And the result is the binormal Gaussian distribution. One should make a remark here that the modular symbols are complex valued, but this is really not a theorem about complex valued one forms, because it is essentially or equivalent to a corollary that works if we use alpha to be a harmonic real valued one form. In this case, we define the modular symbol gamma alpha exactly the same way, only instead of integrating f of z dz, I just integrate alpha. Because now this is real valued alpha, this modular symbol is going to have purely imaginary values, so we'll have to divide by I. And in this case, the normalized modular symbols, exactly the same way, that should have been an alpha here, have a Gaussian distribution on the real line. And the density for that is 1 over square root of 2 pi integral e to the minus x squared over 2. So the number of times that the normalized modular symbol will be in an interval a, b, you have to integrate from a to b the density of the Gaussian distribution. No, at all. Now, what kind of theorem is that? First of all, let's remind ourselves of the pairing of the first cohomology, the Durham cohomology, and first homology that we get out of Stokes' theorem. If you have a one-cycled C and you have a one form, then the pairing between C and omega is the integral of omega along C. Moreover, we have a projection mapping from the group gamma, which is the fundamental group of the quotient, to the first cohomology by abelianization. And essentially, what we are discussing, what theorem 1 and 1 prime are about, they give you information about the values of this pairing in the real line if we take the one form to be real valued, or in the complex plane if we allow complex cohomology classes. And this is a kind of new feature that I have never seen anywhere before. The question, what kind of distribution do we get out of the pairing between homology and the Durham cohomology in the real line? These theorems also remind us of some other theorems concerning matrices in hyperbolic space or hyperbolic quotients. The first one is the analog of the prime number theorem. And this is called the counting prime closed geodesics on the quotient. For every conjugacy class P, so we take P to be, let's say, a matrix, and brackets of P to be its conjugacy class, within that conjugacy class there is going to be a unique closed geodesic, and we are going to order those closed geodesics according to their length of the conjugacy class, or equivalently according to the norm of the matrix. So because P is going to be a hyperbolic matrix with eigenvalues lambda and lambda inverse, then the norm of P is going to be lambda square. And you're going to ask how many closed geodesics you have with norm less than or equal to x, and the result is Li of x. It's an old theorem. Its origins go back to Delsar, Huber, and Selberg. There is a refinement of this theorem, which is due firstly to Adachi and Tsunada, and second to Phillips and Sarnak, if you are going to try to count geodesics not just with length less than or equal to whatever, L and X, but also in a fixed homology class. So you are asking how many now conjugacy classes of norm less than or equal to X have the image in the first homology to be a fixed homology class. And the result is similar to the theorem of primes in arithmetic progression. We get a certain constant that depends on the periods of this form beta, times x divided by the logarithm of x to the g plus 1, where g is the genus of the surface x. Now, I want to give a little bit motivation about why we are interested in modular symbols. So, I write h of gamma to be the modular symbol, and I remind you of the definition here. H is, in fact, an additive homomorphism from the group gamma to the complex numbers with addition, or, for instance, if we're using here a real value differential, to the real numbers with addition. And that we can write it like that, that the modular symbol gamma 1, gamma 2 paired with f is the sum of the two modular symbols. This is a simple consequence that the product of the matrices gamma 1 and gamma 2 corresponds to the sum of the two cycles corresponding to gamma 1 and gamma 2. As a result, we get an image from gamma naught n into the complex numbers with addition, and this is going to be a lattice. And as any lattice in the complex plane, we can fix some sort of basis omega 1 and omega 2, where and the n1s and the n2 here are going to be integers. The quotient dividing C with lambda will be an elliptic curve. Actually, here probably I need to mention something like that F has real coefficients or integer coefficients. And this elliptic curve, we can even write its equation and also find its roots and write down also its discriminant in terms of the roots. I don't so care about the roots, but I do care about the discriminant, what it is. If one is very picky, then one can even write expressions for the periods in terms of the equation, but I don't need that. I need, though, that we have a covering of the elliptic curve by x naught and the modular curve, and as we know, the least n that we can do here will be the conductor. Spiro's conjecture is a statement for a general elliptic curve, at least over Q, bounding the discriminant in terms of the conductor. It asserts that there exists some sort of universal constant kappa so that the discriminant is bounded by some power of the conductor to that kappa power. And of course, kappa doesn't depend on the elliptic curve. Goldfeld tried to understand this conjecture and formulated an equivalent conjecture called the Goldfeld conjecture. The Goldfeld conjecture has the advantage that it works with modular singles rather than mention explicitly the discriminant. However, it doesn't seem that this is an easier conjecture to prove. It requires still that you understand deep properties of the arithmetic of the elliptic curves which are involved. So what the conjecture of Goldfeld does is the following. We take matrices gamma so that the lower left entry C is less than or equal to n squared, where n is the conductor of the elliptic curve. And we look at the modular symbol gamma f. We've said that we can express the modular symbol as a linear combination of the two periods with some coefficients n1 and n2, which will depend, of course, on the holomorphic as form F, but at the same time, on the matrix gamma. If we can bound those coefficients polynomially by n to the k power for all matrices with this property here, then that is equivalent to the Spiro conjecture. Okay? Let me make it clear, the rest of my talk, I am not going to go in any direction trying to prove Goldfeld's conjecture or Spiro's conjecture. Those conjectures are mostly interested in what happens as the conductor of the elliptic curve gets large, as n goes to infinity, and I'm not doing that. Okay, another reason we care about modular symbols is that naturally the central value LF1 of the holomorphic as form can be expressed in terms of the modular symbols. Notice that here I am not using the analyst notation for holomorphic as forms, which created interesting comments in previous lectures. Another comment concerning Goldfeld's conjecture and Spiro conjecture is that it's equivalent to a weak version of ABC. So that conjecture goes deep. Question? Okay. Now, since we are going to talk about Eisenstein series, let's review some elementary facts about non-holomorphic Eisenstein series. Those non-holomorphic Eisenstein series are defined as an automorphization of the function y to the s in the upper half plane. Because y to the s is invariant under parabolics, you have to automorphize over gamma mod gamma infinity, and this is the definition of the non-holomorphic Eisenstein series. Y to the s is at least pointwise an eigenfunction of the Laplace operator, and consequently the automorphization will be an eigenfunction of the Laplace operator, although it is not an L2 function. Here, delta that I use is the hyperbolic Laplace operator, y squared times the Euclidean Laplacian. And the eigenvalue equation is usually written this way, and the eigenvalue is s times 1 minus s. The Eisenstein series, since it is invariant under parabolics, is going to have a Fourier series expansion. And what I wrote here is the Fourier series expansion of the non-holomorphic Eisenstein series for one group only, SL2Z. there is a zero Fourier coefficient, y to the s, plus this expression here that involves a quotient of gamma factors, but more importantly, the quotient zeta to s minus 1 over zeta to s, where zeta is the Riemann zeta function. I didn't write any other Fourier coefficient because actually I'm not going to need them. They're going to decay fairly rapidly in the variable as you go up to the cusp. Now, the Eisenstein series, as written here, is defined only for real part of s bigger than 1, but this expression here and some work tells you that its analytic continuation is essentially equivalent with the analytic continuation of the Riemann zeta function, and consequently of interest. We can calculate its residue at s equals 1, and it is 3 over pi, and it is interesting to notice that 3 over pi is 1 over the volume of the standard fundamental domain for SL to Z, a result that has been discovered by many mathematicians in various contexts, in higher rank groups, etc., many times. What can we get out of that? We can follow the method of the Tauberian argument, or even the method of contour integration, and try to deduce statements out of that. Because you are going to have this residue here, in fact, if you multiply by 2 times zeta of 2s, you are going to sum up over cz plus d squared less than or equal to x, the number 1. The number 1 comes because this generalized Dirichlet series that we see here has, in fact, coefficient 1 in front. And the result is that this is asymptotic to pi x over y, where y is the imaginary part of z. This statement is known for about 200 years because it says it is the Gauss circle problem. You are counting the number of lattice points inside the circle of radius square root of x, and the lattice we are talking about is the one generated by the real number 1 and the complex number z. As a result, we know that this is going to be proportional to the area of the circle, which is pi times x, and we have to divide by the volume of the fundamental domain of the lattice, which is in fact going to be the imaginary part of z, which is y. So that's not very interesting, but this fundamental idea to apply the contour integration to a non-holomorphic Eisenstein series shows up later. Here are the new family of Eisenstein series that are associated with modular symbols. They were introduced by Goldfeld around 1998 and studied extensively by the student of Goldfeld, Cormac O'Sullivan, who incidentally is also at CUNY, and in his thesis. And they're defined as follows. You write imaginary part of gamma z to the s, but in front you twist by the modular symbol gamma s. This Eisenstein series, as I've written it here, converges also for real part of z bigger than 2 in Cormac's thesis, and Cormac spent a lot of time in his thesis trying to prove that it has an analytic continuation in the whole complex plane. The method he used was the original method of Selberg for the analytic continuation of non-holomorphic Eisenstein series adapted to this particular problem here. So it's a method of integral operators. And other people that have studied this kind of series are Cinta and Diamantis, who are also students of Goldfeld at Columbia. There is a little bit of a problem with this Eisenstein series. The problem is that it is not a classical automorphic form. It transforms in a strange way under the action of the group. So if I act by gamma on the element z, I do not get back the Eisenstein series as happens with the standard non-holomorphic Eisenstein series, but you need to subtract a multiple of the modular symbol. And the multiple you need to subtract is the non-holomorphic Eisenstein series that I've mentioned in the previous transparency. On the other hand, the twist you use here in the definition of the non-holomorphic Eisenstein series with modular symbols is just a number. It doesn't depend on the variables x and y. Consequently, since you have y to the s here, and y to the s is an eigenfunction of the hyperbolic Laplace operator, we get that this Eisenstein series is going to be an eigenfunction of the hyperbolic Laplace operator with the same eigenvalue as before. But it does not belong to any nice space. It doesn't belong to the space of invariant functions under gamma. On the other hand, through an argument that does not generalize, Goldfeld and O'Sullivan succeeded in computing the residue of this Eisenstein series at s equals 1, and it is no longer a constant as we had in the previous case. It depends on z the following way. We integrate the holomorphic cusp form from the cusp to Z, and we have the normalizing factor in front 2 pi I over the volume of the quotient. Based on those things, Gödel conjectured that if we can actually apply the method of contour integration, we can get estimates for the average value of the coefficients we put in front for the modular symbols. So we are going to average the modular symbols, gamma s, over c squared plus d squared less than or equal to x, and the condition n divide phi here applies specifically to groups like gamma not n and guarantees essentially that we are working with gamma mod gamma infinity. So this is what condition we should have here, gamma mod gamma infinity with sum of squares of the second row less than or equal to x. We should get the residue at I, because I used z equals I, times x, because the pole is of order 1, plus a remainder term, and I wrote the exponent 1 minus epsilon. What exponent we can take here, it is not always clear. Among other things, it will depend on the existence or not of small eigenvalues. This is currently actually a theorem, but in order to apply the method of contour integration, one needs to be able to bound the Dirichlet series you are going to work with on vertical lines, and that they could not do. As I will explain, that is part of my work. In fact, Goldfeld went further than defining the Eisenstein series twisted by modular symbols in the following direction. We could take two holomorphic cusp forms, S and H, and we can twist by powers of the modular symbol, n powers of the first modular symbol, and maybe the conjugate of n powers of the second modular symbol. And this one can also be proved to have an analytic continuation, but things are a little bit more complicated. For instance, let's take the case where S and H are the same holomorphic cusp form. In that case, the Eisenstein series involved the absolute value of the modular symbol square, and this is a much better Dirichlet series because it has positive coefficients. So his conjecture was that this has a pole of order 1 at s equals 1 with residue proportional to the Peterson inner product, the norm we saw at the beginning, norm of f square. And based on that conjecture, he went further to conjecture that for a congruent subgroup, the absolute value square of a modular symbol should be the residue of this Eisenstein series E11 at s equals 1 times x. As we're going to see, part of this conjecture is true, part of this conjecture is false. In any case, as an application of the first conjecture that he had concerning E10, he and O'Sullivan could state something interesting about logarithms in congruent subgroups like gamma not 11. Let's remind ourselves that essentially any homomorphism from the positive real numbers with multiplication to the real numbers with addition is called a logarithm. The question is whether you could define logarithms in more general groups, particularly in non-abelian groups. In general, the answer is no, because there could be more than one way that you could express an element of the group in terms of generators. But here is the example that they have worked out. We are going to work with gamma not 11, and he puts down a specific presentation of the group. We take AB to be the two hyperbolic matrices that you see here, and we take also P naught and P infinity to be two parabolic matrices, this one and this one here. This group has only two cusps at 0 at infinity, and here is the word satisfied by all those matrices. We see that in this word here, if we sum the exponents of A, we get 0 because of 1 and minus 1, and the same thing for B. That actually allows you to define in an invariant way the logarithm of any matrix in the group. So what we do is that we write a matrix element in the group as powers of A times some powers of B times some other powers of A times some other powers of B, maybe also some parabolics and things like that. And then what we are going to define the logarithm to be is the sum of the exponents we see for A. And exactly because of this relation, this is well defined. According to the first theorem now of Gödel on that, we can get results on averaging the logarithms of elements of the group gamma in the base A. And the result can be expressed this way. It is t over y with this expression here that depends on z. where does this expression with Dedekind-Eta function shows up, what they had to do is in fact write down a specific basis of holomorphic cast forms for gamma naught 11. So that's it. By the way, the theorem that I stated at the beginning, theorem 1 or theorem 1 prime, will in fact give you a distribution law for logarithms in the base A in this case. So not just averaging the elements, the logarithms, but also the squares, the cubes, and all the powers. I will come to that maybe later. Okay. So let's now state some more theorems. Our first theorem is that actually we now have the best domain of absolute convergence of this Eisenstein series of Goldfield. They converge absolutely for real part of S bigger than 1, while initially O'Sullivan put bigger than m plus n plus 1. And in fact, they have a meromorphic continuation to all of C, and we have a new proof also of the meromorphic continuation to all of C. I will show you the proof later on. As a result, actually, once you know where a certain series converges, particularly if it has positive coefficients, you could get estimates on the order of growth of the coefficients. And we could get an estimate of the form that the modular symbols grow like c squared plus d squared to the power epsilon, for any epsilon. And this is as the elements vary over gamma, s is fixed, as I've said. This is actually not the best result that is known, because in an old paper of 1967, Eichler has proved that actually you could have logarithm of c squared plus d squared. The next theorem that we have gives the growth of the Eisenstein series of Goldfield on vertical lines. What we do is the following. We are going to concentrate on the right half plane, so the real part of S is going to be bigger than a half and less than or equal to 1, and we will restrict the Z in a compact set. Quite often you just have to take it to be just one point. And then we are going to give bounds on this Eisenstein series on vertical lines depending on the imaginary part of S. So this is the kind of bound we have. It depends on m and n, and of course on the distance from the critical line. I don't claim that this bound is the best possible. And that theorem actually allows to get error terms in the Tauberian argument, in the method of contour integration. Without that, you can't proceed. The next theorem that we have concerns the Eisenstein series E to 0, which involves the square of the modular symbol. And this number is still a complex number, not necessarily real. So this has a simple pole at s equals 1, and the residue is in fact the integral from the cusp to z squared times a certain normalizing factor involving the volume. Theorem 6, where things start getting interesting, because this is where we prove that Goldfield was partly wrong. The Eisenstein series E11, where we involve the modular symbol with absolute value squares, so we deal with only non-negative numbers, has in fact a double pole at s equals 1, and its singular part is going to be more complicated. There is going to be the pole s minus 1 squared here, and we see that the coefficient here does indeed involve the Petersen norm square as predicted by Goldfield. So the normalizing factors actually here are important, because when you try to prove a distributional result, you're trying to match moments of your sequence of numbers with the moments, let's say, of the Gaussian distribution, and you're not allowed to be away in the moments by a factor of 2 or 3. The residue actually for this Eisenstein series is a more complicated expression. Let me tell you what it involves. It involves the absolute value of the period from I infinity to Z of the holomorphic cast form square, plus a new expression here, where E0 is the result we get out of the application of Kronecker's limit formula to the Eisenstein series. Recall, the Eisenstein series has a pole at S equals 1 with residue 1 over the volume. Take out the pole and take the limit as S goes to 1, that's the E0. And what is R0 ZZ prime? As I will explain later, there is a kernel for the resolvent of the Laplace operator, and that will also have a pole at S equals 1, and you do exactly the same thing. You take out the pole and you let S go to 1. As a result, taking into account that we now know the structure of the pole at S equals 1, and we have bounds on vertical lines, the method of contour integration will give us estimates for the gamma f squared and the absolute gamma f squared average over gamma mod gamma infinity all the way up to x this way. And we get here an x plus an error term, and here we get an x log x because of the double pole plus a big O of x. The big O of x essentially here means that you can write the next term because it's going to come out of the residue and of this pole here, and we haven't just bothered to do it. Here in this case, one thing we can say is that this error depends again on the existence of small eigenvalues and on the best possible values, best possible bounds on vertical lines that we might have. Assuming we have no small eigenvalues, we can get here the exponent to be 12 over 13. Okay. And two more theorems of the same nature, and the only ones that I'm going to mention. Let's start with theorem 9 here. We can also work with E3, 0, and E2, 1, which is the next case where the sum is, in fact, 3. E3, 0, that involves gamma f cubed, has still a simple pole at s equals 1, and the residue seems to start making sense. You take the integral from I infinity to z, and you cube it. On the other hand, E2, 1 has a double pole at s equals 1, and now you're going to get the Petersen norm squared times one of those factors up here. And in fact, you can analyze what can be the structure we are going to get for em, 0. However, all those things are not so important more than what order of pole we get for those. The most important one is the emm, where the exponents here are the same, and which involves the absolute value of gamma f to the 2m power. For this one, we need to know the exact order of the pole and the leading coefficient, because that should match with the corresponding moment of the complex Gaussian. And the result that we get is that the order of the pole is exactly m plus 1, and the leading coefficient involves the Petersen norm to the 2m, m plus 1 powers of the volume, 16 pi squared to the n and n factorial square. Now, those are the main theorems we have about the Eisenstein series associated with modular symbols. Let me now pass to the next section about Eisenstein series associated with characters, chi epsilon. Those Eisenstein series, instead of using the modular symbol, in front they have a multiplicative character. And multiplicative characters are good because, after all, the theory of automorphic forms is part of multiplicative number theory. And it is not good to put things in front which were additive characters like modular symbols. And careful listeners will notice that it is very easy to pass from additive characters to multiplicative characters. We just exponentiate. So what we do here is that we take a character which is the exponential of the modular symbol, but we introduce an extra parameter epsilon. So this theory of Eisenstein series with characters is, in fact, a theory of Eisenstein series with parameters. And I'm going, in fact, to embed the whole problem of Eisenstein series with modular symbols in a family of automorphic forms, this family with characters, but it's a continuous family. Now, it has happened that since I was a graduate student, I have taught 29 courses in calculus. And as a result, I hope I know how to differentiate. So here is the idea. The idea is that if we take the derivative in epsilon of the Eisenstein series with characters and we set epsilon equals 0, then we recover the Eisenstein series of Goldfield, E10. And there is an advantage of working with the Eisenstein series with characters. They are standard automorphic forms that transform according to the conjugate of the character chi epsilon. Okay, so this idea I used about a year ago in a paper that has appeared to give a new proof of the analytic continuation of the Eisenstein series and study how the poles behave on the critical line. I'll come back to that a little bit later. Let me give you a little bit of flavor of the idea, because this is where the perturbations of the Laplace operator come to play a role. What we do is that we are considering functions which transform according to the character chi epsilon. But it is convenient in perturbation theory, once you have a family of Hilbert spaces, to switch to a single Hilbert space, and that Hilbert space will be L2 of the quotient. You do that by using a certain family of unitary operators, and this family of unitary operators, U epsilon, is defined as follows. You take a function h, which is in L2 here, and you multiply it in front by exponential of 2 pi I epsilon, the integral from the cusp to z of w, where w is, let's say, a one form. Then we have also the Laplace operator acting on this Hilbert space, and we are going to use the unitary operators to conjugate the Laplace operator to a new family of operators that act on the fixed Hilbert space L2 of H mod gamma. And the whole theory of perturbations of the Laplacian as applied to the Eisenstein series I introduced is essentially the perturbation theory of this family of operators L sub epsilon. There is a history about those operators. So let me tell you the history of those things. This kind of perturbations with unitary operators and applied to cusp forms was used by Sarnak in 1989, where he was studying perturbations in character varieties. The problem there is to prove that if we have a cusp form for a congruent subgroup under a perturbation in the character variety, this cusp form disappears, or more precisely becomes a resonance. And Sarnak has formulated, together with Phillips, a general condition that if it is satisfied, will give you the destruction disappearance of cusp form. The perturbation deformation is going to depend, for the case of a character variety, on a holomorphic form of weight 2, exactly as we have in this case. And the condition is as follows. We take phi j to be the mass cusp form with eigenvalue corresponding to sj, so the eigenvalue is sj times 1 minus sj, and we take the Rankine-Seidel convolution of f and phi j, and we look at the spatial point sj plus a half. If this L function at this point is not zero, then the cusp form is destroyed. In fact, a little bit later in 92, Phillips and Sarnak made the condition a little bit more precise and framed it into the framework of Fermi's golden rule. We study here the second variation of the eigenvalue, and we take its real part, and this is in fact minus the absolute value square of the spatial value times some gamma factors, which I'm not going to write down. I use the same kind of deformations in character varieties in the year 2000 to study a different perturbation problem. I was actually studying what happens to scattering pulse for gamma naught p, where p is a prime number. When p is a prime number, there are only two Eisenstein series. The standard Eisenstein series is at s and EPZ s. And both of them are going to have the pulse prescribed by the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, because we saw in the expansion the zeta to s in the denominator. And in fact, the scattering pulse for gamma naught p are going to be exactly on the vertical line at 1/4 if and only if the Riemann hypothesis is true. This is only a reformulation of the Riemann hypothesis, and one should not put too much faith to try to prove the Riemann hypothesis this way. That was included as a section in the book of Lux and Phillips, How Not to Prove the Riemann Hypothesis. But moreover, there is the theorem that I proved in that paper that says that when you start perturbing in the character variety, what will happen is that a positive proportion of the scattering pulse will move off the line prescribed by the Riemann hypothesis, assuming that the central value of the L function of the cusp form of weight 2 is non-zero. Okay. Now we get to theorem 10, which is an interesting story. O'Sullivan proved theorem 10 in his thesis, but he has never published it, and I think I should certainly attribute the theorem to him. I reproved it about a couple of years later with my techniques of perturbation. He had different techniques, and the result is as follows. The Eisenstein series of Goldfeld has a very annoying fact. It has infinite number of poles on the critical line, and in fact it has a pole every time we have Sj to be a cuspidal eigenvalue. In fact, we can study even the residues at the poles. They are the L values that we saw for the Rankine-Seidel convolution times some gamma function times the eigenfunction. So they depend on the eigenfunctions phi L. There could be a bunch of them. The multiplicity doesn't have to be one, but they depend on the spatial value that we see here. In fact, Goldfield had noticed that this special value that shows at the residue is exactly the same one that shows up in the Phillips-Arnold condition, but could not make the relation between the Eisenstein series with modular symbols and the perturbation methods of Phillips and Sarnak. Now, I have to add some remarks which are rather new. Assume that the special values of the Rankine-Selberg convolution are in fact zero for some reason, which doesn't quite happen, but never mind. Then we are not going to have a pole on the critical line at the corresponding point. So you may ask, what is the value of the Eisenstein series with modular symbols there? And the analysis that I have done there tells you that actually you have to take the derivative of the Rankine-Selberg convolution at the same height. And then there are some other terms about which I would not like to talk, and some gamma factors. The interesting thing is that the derivative here is in the variable s. On the other hand, as I'm trying to convince you, the theory of Eisenstein series with modular symbols is a theory of perturbations in the epsilon parameter. So we are doing something in the epsilon parameter, and all of a sudden we see a special value of a Rankine-Selberg convolution, actually its derivative. And that's a new feature. And there is now actually another new feature. Let's look at the case of gamma naught Q, where Q is a prime. We can actually prove that the Eisenstein series with modular symbols is going to have poles also at rho over 2, where rho is a non-trivial zero of the Riemann zeta function. I'm going to assume, let's say, the generalized Riemann hypothesis and the simplicity of the zeros. Actually, I only need the Riemann hypothesis for gamma naught Q, but never mind. In this case, the pole is going to be double. And we can also talk about the coefficient of s minus s naught to the minus 2, and we get a bunch of gamma factors, the central value at 1, and some other value of s on the line of absolute convergence. And this product that we see here is exactly the same condition that I got in the year 2000 about perturbing scattering poles. And now you can ask what happens if the central value is 0. And what we get is that the residue then involves a bunch of terms, and one of those terms is the derivative at the central value times the value of the L function on the line of absolute convergence. The innovation here, and the reason why I'm excited about it, it is for the first time we see in a spectral problem the derivative of the central value to play a role, assuming that the central value is zero. Okay. Well, it will not be averages over n. You mean of the whole... it's not clear how useful expressions I could get. That's why I'm not saying that this has led to a major breakthrough. Okay, so let's now prove the analytic continuation of the Eisenstein series of Goldfield in this transparency. As I've said, we are using those operators U epsilon to move objects that transform under chi epsilon bar, like the Eisenstein series perturbed by a character chi epsilon, to fixed objects dz s epsilon on the fixed, let's say, space of invariant functions h mod gamma. The Eisenstein series satisfied the eigenvalue equation. That will now give us an eigenvalue equation for this dz s epsilon, but now we have to conjugate the Laplacian to the family of operators L sub epsilon. And then from this thing here, because we saw that we have to differentiate this E sub epsilon in the epsilon variable, you have to do the same thing here. So you're going to take the eigenvalue equation and differentiate it. This is the major point in perturbation theory. So you differentiate as I do here, and then you solve for D dot, which is the derivative at epsilon equals zero. To solve, you need to invert this operator delta plus s times 1 minus s. And the inverse of this operator is called the resolvent. And the resolvent is known to have an analytic continuation to the whole complex plane. This must have been known by Selberg and certainly was put down in a paper by Faidieff in 1967. So we get an expression for d dot that is minus the resolvent. And then we have to apply that operator in the following function. We take the non-holomorphic Eisenstein series EZS, and we apply the infinitesimal variation of this family of operators. It can be proved that we can actually assume that the infinitesimal variation is compactly supported, and then the non-holomorphic Eisenstein series has an analytic continuation. You apply a compactly supported thing, you get compactly supported data, you can apply to that the resolvent which has an analytic continuation, and as a result we get the analytic continuation of D dot, and from that immediately we'll get the analytic continuation of the derivative of V sub epsilon. So that's the shortest proof of the analytic continuation of the Eisenstein series of Goldfeld. Now, some comments concerning the other theorem about the growth on vertical lines. There is a problem in proving growth on vertical lines for the Eisenstein series of Goldfeld for the following reason. Usually, you prove growth on vertical lines by looking at the right half plane where you have absolute convergence and where you are bounded, and looking at the left half plane where you're going to use the functional equation and applying Fragment Lindelöf of principle in the vertical street. The problem with the Eisenstein series of Goldfeld is that they have infinite number of poles and with fairly crazy residues on the critical line. There were all those mass cut forms that were playing a role, plus the special values of the corresponding Rankine-Seidel convolutions. And he had no way of controlling them, essentially multiplying out all those things and getting rid of them. So I use a different technique, which is as follows, and essentially goes back to the expression I wrote in the previous transparency for D dot. The expression was that I had to apply the resolvent to L dot of E. So I have somehow first to prove growth on vertical lines for the non-holomorphic Eisenstein series, and this is not too difficult in the general case. The zero Fourier coefficient of the Eisenstein series involves phi of S, which is called the scattering matrix. It's a quotient of gamma factors times some constants to certain powers times a generalized Dirichlet series with first coefficient 1. And because we have first coefficient 1, we know that very much to the right, we are going to get something non-zero. Then by using the standard method of Fragment-Lindelöf, so you're dividing the Eisenstein series with this Dirichlet series, you apply functional equation, etc., you get bounds for the Eisenstein series. Then you need to get bounds, essentially, for what we get here. To do that, we have to use a well-known formula for the operator norm of the resolvent of, let's say, an operator. It tells you that the operator norm can be bounded exactly by 1 over the distance from the point Z where you're computing the resolvent to the spectrum of the operator A. And this is applies in the operator norm and consequently will give you an L2 result. And since you want pointwise bounds on vertical lines, you have to use the Sobolev embedding theorem at the end. Okay. So to finish my talk, I'm going to mention certain questions that exist and remain. The first thing is what happens for core compact groups gamma, even, for instance, for groups that coming out of quaternion algebras. At this moment, our theorem does not apply to those because we are heavily using Eisenstein series. And we don't quite know how to do the most interesting thing on co-compact groups, which would be to order the modular symbols according to the length of the corresponding geodesic, which corresponds to order the matrices according to A squared plus B squared plus C squared plus D squared. On the other hand, recently Rizager has done a generalization of our theorem in the following way. We can take, let's say, hyperbolic matrix gamma, and if we assume that a holomorphic form has period zero along this closed geodesic, then one can define easily hyperbolic Eisenstein series. This has been done and has been used a lot of times by Kudla, and then we still get the Gauss distribution for the modular symbols. There are other things that have been done by Goldfeld and his students that have considered Eisenstein series corresponding to cut forms of weight bigger than 2. At this moment, my techniques do not work, but there exist representations of the group into various symmetric powers, etc., in which case we're going to have a method of working with perturbation as well. A more interesting case happens in the case of higher rank, another paper of Goldfeld and Gunnels. They had defined Eisenstein series associated with modular symbols corresponding, let's say, to higher order co-cycles for SLn. Let's say for SL3, they talk about 2 cycles, and that corresponds not to closed curves, but to closed 2-dimensional varieties. In this case, I do not know what to do for the time being because the trick of exponentiation that I have used does not work. From a two cocycle, if you exponentiate, you do not get a character or a representation. Somehow, we still think that maybe something could be done in this case. I would like to finish with a short remark that I believe that this method of perturbation that I have introduced here is very powerful, and it is the first application, the distribution of modular symbols, after the issue of destruction disappears of cast forms. And quite likely there are going to be more applications in the future. Thank you.